So we are picking up in the first book of Kings, just kind of the 10,000 foot level. We're continuing our historical narrative of the nation of Israel. We got up to David's reign through most of it in 2 Samuel, and so now we're going to look at 120 years or so to come after that, which is really broken into two parts. Solomon's reign, which is about 40 years, it is 40 years, and then after Solomon dies, when the nation is broken in two, it becomes two separate nations, one referred to as Israel, which is 10 of the tribes, and then the nation of Judah, and then it follows their respective kings down through time. Who wrote 1 Kings? No idea. I can't find any clues on the author. There are some clues about when it was written. We've been using this expression under this day to get an idea about context clues. So the one that shows up here in 1 Kings is in 1 Kings 8 and 8. And this is talking about the poles that are in the side of the ark. It says they drew out the staves. The end of the staves were seen out in the holy place before the oracle, and they were not seen without. And they're there into this day. All right, what's they talking about? Well, after Solomon built the temple, there was no need for the ark to be carried around anymore. It was there and it's going to be permanent. Before that, when it was going around with the mobile tabernacle, which is the tent, it had these poles on the side of the ark where they would be carried by the priest. Well, this is saying that once it was put inside the most holy places within the temple, they took the staves out of the side of the ark and they left them in the most holy place. And that's where they were under this day. So what that tells us? It tells us that the temple hadn't been destroyed yet. That's what the Babylonians did when they took Judah into captivity. They completely destroyed the temple. So this is written sometime before then. That's about the only clue that I've found. If y'all got others, feel free to shoot it my way. You can update that. All right, so we just set our time period and the overview. Really picks up from 2 Samuel. David's not dead yet. At the end of 2 Samuel, David had kind of had his last major error where he numbered the people and there's massive plague. He has to build an altar on the threshing floor, which turns out to be the future site of the temple where Solomon will build. And so 1 Kings picks up sometime in the final years of David's reign. We don't know exactly how long he lived when it picks up, but it's described as very old. And then it follows through with when he designates that Solomon's actually going to replace him. He had another son who tried to take the mantle again. So he formally puts Solomon in as king, and he's made king while David is yet alive, which is kind of interesting. So the first half of the book, Solomon's reign, 40 years. The second half is the next 80 years, during which the kingdom is divided, like we just talked about. And during that 80-year period, Judah goes through four different kings, and each of these are going to be a direct descendant of David. There's on the other side of the coin, in Israel, you're going to go through seven kings. Of those, three of which are going to be overthrown and murdered. So kind of volatile nation, a lot more turnover, if you will. And then the book ends just right after the death of Israel's sixth king, who's the notoriously wicked King Ahab. And then I reference you to the chart, which I put at the end of the handout. And you know, this is a work in progress. I'm still trying to figure out the best way to put this visual together. But just as far as your color coding, green means they're doing good and obeying God. When you've got this transition of green to red, they start off good, they get off track. And then the guys who are just red are the ones who are just really in gross idolatry the whole time. And then you've got some who are just green, doing a pretty good job. The scripture describes them as being faithful to God's ways. So those are not my judgment calls. That's just relaying what the scripture said, the summary of their reign. All right. So jumping into it, this is, like I said, a lot of material, about a 40-page book, very detailed. The first half of it is only a 40-year span, and the next half is covering the next 80 years. There's a lot of characters. Again, that chart should be helpful. So pick up chapter 1. David is now old, feeble. It said his body didn't get heat anymore. And so his advisors come up with a plan. They say, let's give him a young female to restore some vitality to him. Her name is Abishag. She was a Shunammite, a town named Shunam. But it didn't work. She cared for him, ministered to him, but he didn't revive. And never knew her. His wife, so that was his concubine. Now his son, Adonijah decides he's going to be king. David's still technically king, but he's, you know, kind of greatly weakened by his age. And now this happens to be Absalom's younger brother. Absalom's the guy who tried to overthrow David when he was in his prime. Failed, and Absalom was killed by Joab. So Adonijah decides he's going to be king. He starts to set in a plan to make this happen. And he enlists the help of some of David's top officers, one being Joab himself, who was the captain of all of David's armies, despite being fired and murdering his replacement. He's back as captain. And he also recruits Abiathar, who was one of the two high priests at that time. Now, Abiathar, if you remember, he was the sole survivor of Saul's massacre of those priests in the city of Nob. Let's see, 1 Samuel chapter 22. He's also a descendant of Eli. Remember him, who Samuel came and worked with. David, before this time, had already told Bathsheba, that's the wife of Uriah the Hittite, who David had murdered and had an affair with and had a child with, and God killed the child for David's sin. Well, she had another child. His name was Solomon. So David had already told Bathsheba that Solomon was going to be the king after him. And, you know, Bathsheba, seeing Adonijah's scheme, her, along with Nathan the prophet, go to David to try and jar him into action, saying, if you do not know that Adonijah is really already reigning, and, you know, if you don't do something, you know, Bathsheba and Solomon, you know, my son, we're going to be, you know, offenders and put to death. That's the fear, at least. So David, you know, responding to their prompts, goes ahead and installs Solomon as the king before he's dead. So there's no concern over who would be the rightful ruler. Adonijah hears the great fanfare and celebration. He's off having his own party with all the king's sons and his followers, and they're kind of getting their selves riled up. And while they're doing that is when David installs Solomon, and all the people are cheering. And so Adonijah's followers just kind of fade away. And he goes to Solomon and he pleads for his life, and don't kill me. And Solomon says, okay, I'll spare you, but on the one condition, you have to show yourself to be a worthy man. We'll see whether he does it or not. Chapter 2 picks up, David gives Solomon a charge. He gives him actually several instructions, but primarily the theme is that he needs to be strong and to keep the law of God. He needs to follow God, which is what David was known for. That other than those two major mistakes he made, he did a good job of seeking the Lord in all things. And so he wants Solomon to follow after his footsteps. He also gives him some instructions to deal with two men who David really should have dealt with, but for whatever reason, he didn't. One being Joab, who's, you know, the captain of the armies and had murdered several people. Abner, who was Ishbosheth's commander-in-chief, who was kind of come over to serve David and was going to end the civil war. And then also Amasa, who was the new commander-in-chief after Joab killed Absalom. So he said, don't let him go to the grave in peace. And the same thing for Shimeiah. You may not remember who Shimeiah is. This was that relation of Saul who, when David was fleeing from Absalom, had come out to throw rocks and dust and curse David. And when David beat Absalom and came back into Jerusalem, Shimeiah was the first one to meet him at the River Jordan. He said, you know, so sorry, I shouldn't have said that, don't kill me. And so that day, David promised that he wouldn't kill him. Now, he doesn't extend that promise to Solomon. He says, Solomon, you're a wise man, you know what to do. And so Solomon calls Shimeiah and says, you know, here's the deal. You build a house inside Jerusalem. As long as you stay in Jerusalem, you're safe. Basically house arrest. You leave Jerusalem, your life is forfeit. After several years, Shimeiah does leave. He's got some servants that run away. And so Solomon calls him in and says, I told you. And then he puts him to death for violating the terms. Adonijah, who, you know, already once tried to become king, tries a second time to supplant Solomon. Now, he's his older brother. And so his plan, he calls Bathsheba, Solomon's mama, and says, go make a request to the king for me. Request that David's concubine, Abishag, that young girl who David, you know, never played with but was still his concubine, ask her to be my wife. And but Solomon, you know, when Bathsheba does that, Solomon sees through his plot and says, you know, why don't you just go ahead and ask for the kingdom for my older brother? Because, I mean, if I'm going to give him, you know, my father's wife to wife, you know, I need a greater claim to be the king. And so he calls Adonijah and puts him to death because he didn't show himself a worthy man, continuing to plot and scheme. And then Solomon also thrust out Abiathar. He was one of the two chief priests. He followed after Adonijah and Adonijah's original plot. He thrust him out from being a priest. And why this is significant is this fulfills God's promise that he made to Eli back in 1 Samuel. Remember, Eli had those two sons who were just real shysters, and Eli didn't do anything about it, and the prophet came and said, your descendants are going to be kicked out from being priests. So this is the fulfillment of it years down the road, because that was before Saul was made king, and so we're now 120 plus years down the road that at least is being fulfilled. And so Abiathar is kicked out from being the priest. And I've got a reference to a key verse that we pulled up there, so let's see what that is. So this is David's charge to Solomon. It says, I go the way of all the earth. Be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways, keep his statutes and his commandments and his judgments and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that thou mayest prosper in all that thou doest, and whithersoever thou turnest thyself, that the Lord may continue his word which he spake concerning me. If thy children take heed to their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, there shall not fail thee, said he, a man on the throne of Israel. So that was the promise that God had made to David, that as long as his children will continue to seek his ways and follow after his paths, they'll still be the kings on his throne. All right, so we're up to chapter 3. So Solomon is sacrificing in Gibeon, and this is a high place. Now, this is actually wrong. They're not supposed to sacrifice in high places. Well, high places were literally, they go to like the top of a mountain or someplace where you're close to the sky, and they build an altar there, and they would sacrifice to the Lord. Well, this is a practice that had occurred before the law. Abraham and Isaac, they were always building altars wherever they're going around. But after the law, they were instructed that they were only to perform their sacrifices at the altar, which was originally with the tabernacle and then eventually would be in the temple. And so Solomon is not obeying here. And this practice of continuing to sacrifice in high places would actually follow through a lot of the descendants down David's line as they continue this practice. Either way, while he's there sacrificing, the Lord appears to him. So this is the first time the Lord has appeared to Solomon. He appears to him in a dream. And he basically asks, what do you want me to give you? And so Solomon thinks about it, and what he asks for is wisdom. He says he'd like wisdom and discernment, that he can be a good judge of God's people. Now, that's one of the king's primary responsibilities. You know, we've got courts and everything you go to if you've got a fight between two people and they can tell you who wins and who loses. Well, the king was the ultimate judge. They had some underlings there in the system, but the king was the final judge. And so he wanted to be able to give righteous judgment to decide who's right and who's wrong. So he needed wisdom. And so the Lord blesses him that. He actually blesses him to be the wisest man to ever live, accepting only Jesus, who's obviously wiser than God. And he said because he didn't ask for riches and honor, God would give him those too. And then in that chapter, Solomon's wisdom is quickly put on display when he has to settle the dispute between the two harlots, both of whom are claiming to be the rightful mother of a living infant. Remember one of the harlots, I'm sure you've heard this story before, one of the harlots, they both had the babies within days of each other, they lived in the same house, no one else was there. One of the harlots rolled over on her baby in the night and smothered it. When she saw her child was dead, she went and took the other ones and swapped the kids. And so now they're before the king saying, you need to tell us whose is whose, and so they're both fighting about it. And so Solomon calls for a sword, literally. Brings a sword to him out in front of him, not just saying, yeah, I guess we ought to cut the kids up. But he like brings a sword and he says, here's what we'll do. We'll just cut the child in two and give half to each woman. And the women had greatly different responses to this proposition. The woman who it wasn't her child says, that's fine. Split it in half. Then neither of us will have it. It'll be neither mine nor thine. And the one who's actually is her son, she says, give it to her. Let her be the mother. And so based on the reaction, the true mother's identity was clearly revealed. And it says from that point on, the people began to fear Solomon for his wisdom. So that was just a small example of one of the times his wisdom was put on display. Chapter 4 picks up with kind of a roll call of who are the key persons in Solomon's government and their various roles and responsibilities. It also gives a good description of the vastness of Solomon's territory and his wealth. This would be a good thing to kind of check off when you're looking at a map and seeing how big it is. And in general, there's peace and prosperity in Israel during Solomon's reign. And then they talk about his wisdom. It was famous, and people traveled all over to hear him speak. And he spoke 3,000 proverbs, many of which are recorded in the book of Proverbs. And he also wrote 1,005 songs. Chapter 5 picks up with Hiram. Who's Hiram? Hiram's the king of Tyre. What's Tyre? Tyre is a port city on the coast of the Mediterranean. It is referenced frequently in the Bible in a negative context. Tyre and Sidon, which is a kind of neighboring port city, are often kind of examples of worldly places focused on goods, riches, material things. And so there's some curses about them later in Scripture, but just kind of remember that that's a significant location. It's worthy of knowing. But this time, Hiram, who is an ally of Solomon, he sends Solomon cedar. So they cut down this very expensive, fancy, long-lasting wood in Lebanon, which is up near the region of Tyre, and then they float it down and then carry it up to Jerusalem, which would be really no small thing to logistically to get these big old trees down. That's pretty far away. And so Solomon uses a cedar to build both the temple. So he's been given instructions and plans from David of this is how God wants you to build the temple. David wasn't authorized to do it. He was a man of war, but Solomon was blessed with peace all of his days, and he was able to build the temple. And he also built his own house or palace using these cedar trees. And so if you look at the map number one, I don't have it on this handout, but in the whole list of it back that showed the inheritances of the 12 tribes, I think that was right in the Solomon Joshua handout, you can see where Tyre is located on there. So chapter 6, we get a year marker. It says in the 480th year since Israel came out of Egypt, Solomon begins to build the temple. So you can kind of build that into your mental map and timeline about how far along we've come. I'm not sure if that's literally when they came out of Egypt or when they came into Canaan. There's commentators who argue about it a great deal. I'm not really that worried about it. That's what it says. So that's roughly where we're at. Solomon begins to build the temple, and he begins building the temple during the fourth year of his four-year reign. In this chapter, you get great detail, the measurements of how the temple is going to be laid out. It's laid out in cubits, and the rough conversion for that is about 18 inches. It's not precise. My understanding of a cubit is roughly the distance between your elbow and your wrist, which is not exactly a standard unit. But so if you want to convert that to feet, you know, multiply by 18 and divide by 12. It takes Solomon 7 years to complete the temple. The foundation is made of these very large stones, and they cut all these big stones off-site and then shipped them in to finish. So you weren't hearing a bunch of hammers and rocks and picks going while they're there. So they're cut off-site, and they're rolled in on however they got from there as a foundation. And then on top of that, you had the structure, which was made out of that cedar that we got from Lebanon. And then the whole house, I know at least the interior, I'm not sure about the exterior, is overlaid with gold. So you didn't see the cedar itself. It had a gold covering on top of it. Later down in time, other kings, when they're in real trouble and need money, will actually damage the temple to scrape off that gold to give it to people who are trying to invade. So chapter 7, we learn that Solomon's house is completed in 13 years. So he spent 7 years on the temple, and he spent a total of 13 years building his own house or palace. You get some additional details about the temple in this chapter, and then some of the different furnishings were crafted by an artisan or a brass craftsman named Hiram. He's also the city of Tyre. This is not the king. The king didn't come down here to do the brass work. Different guy. But he built some really neat things. One of those is two pillars. They're about 27 feet tall, about 6 feet wide. And they're made of brass, and they've got some fancy decorations on it. You can just read all that detail work and try and visualize it. He also built this big sea. Basically, it was like a big fancy round tub, about 15 feet wide, and it sat on a really cool base that was made out of 12 oxen, you know, two facing each direction, north, south, east, and west. So you got that big C, and then you had some lobbers. Basically, these are like washing stations. And then they had 10 bases that went underneath those. And then there's various other instruments. And so a lot of detail work in Chapter 7. And so you guys really have your imagination kind of tuned up. I'd recommend trying to, like, draw these things based on the details that you get, just to kind of get a visual. You don't know exactly beyond the details that are given, but it's neat. So Chapter 8, during the Feast of the Tabernacles, Israel will celebrate the completion and the dedication of the temple. And this, by they doing that, they bring in the ark into the temple. And I believe that's where we get that verse about taking the staves out. So Solomon is very, very wealthy. He's got a ton of goods, and he winds up sacrificing many animals. So many so that in one portion it says they can't be counted, and in another portion of, I think, the same chapter, it talks about being in the hundreds of thousands. I mean, just crazy volumes of sacrifices, so much so that the bronze altar couldn't handle them all, so they actually hallowed or made holy a portion of the courtyard to offer them there. And then the end of the chapter, Solomon blesses the people, and he gives a lengthy prayer to the Lord. Now, remember this prayer, because this picks up in Chapter 9. God comes and talks to Solomon about this prayer. But what's noteworthy about it is that God doesn't come and talk to him until many years later. All right? So that dedication, year 7, right? That was how long it took to build the temple. In Chapter 9, it says, after Solomon's house has been completed. So we're at least 13 years down the road, and so 6 years at least after the temple is completed. This is when the Lord appears to Solomon the second time. So 6 years after that prayer, at least 6 years, it could have been more, the Lord appears to Solomon and acknowledges that he heard Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple. So if you ever get discouraged by feeling like God's not hearing you, it may just take them a long time to answer your prayers. So don't be discouraged. It's in his time. So he makes a promise to Solomon to establish his kingdom forever if Solomon will follow God's ways. But he also warns them that if Solomon goes to worship other gods, then God will cast Israel out of the land. That ultimately happens. It's ultimately fulfilled during the captivity. In this chapter, we also have time passage up until the 20th year of Solomon's reign. Right? So I think it's another 3 years, because he started building the tabernacle in the fourth year. Anyway, so up to 20 year, and you get some additional details on kind of the economy, the economic dealings of Solomon, with Hiram, remember that king of Tyre, with Pharaoh, who's king of Egypt. Solomon has this massive navy. It goes around and gathers this real wonderful gold. And it also talks about the taxes that he levies on those seven nations that should have been destroyed. Remember the seven nations that Joshua had instructed to not make leagues or peace treaties with, but all the tribes failed to ultimately cast them all out. So this is described in the taxes or tribute, which is another way to describe it, that were levied upon them. Chapter 10, you get a visit from Queen of Sheba. I don't know exactly where Sheba is. I think it's likely in Africa, but there's not much details on the Queen of Sheba, other than she came to visit Solomon, and she had a great train and host with her and really fancy stuff, and she came to test him, because she'd heard about his wisdom, and she wanted to come, and she had many questions all teed up, and she wanted to test him, and so after she did and asked all the questions, she was really forced to admit that the half of Solomon's wisdom and the greatness of his kingdom hadn't been told to her. That, even she thought she was kind of blown out of proportion just hearing about it, and it didn't even cover half of it. And then you get descriptions of Solomon's great riches, his annual income and gold, his cool throne was made out of ivory, which is one of the tusks of elephants, or some animal like that, the ivory, and then on top of the ivory was gold, and he's got these steps going up to the throne, and on each side there's really neat lions. Never been a throne like it, so you get a good description of that. And also, he's also got 1,400 chariots and 24,000 horsemen. I mean, just opulence. I mean, the Lord really, really blessed him with great wealth. Chapter 11 gets to your But Solomon loved strange women. And we're not saying they had odd personalities. We're saying these are women who were not of Israel, who had customs and religions that were not in line with what the Jews had been instructed to do. And he gets drawn in to really gross idolatry. This is not just little slip-ups, but gross idolatry by these strange women, by these women of other nations. And to give you an idea of the volume, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And I guess, you know, concubine, I really don't understand the concept. It's just so foreign to us. Like, it's a second-tier wife, still a wife, but either way, 1,000 women in his life. And they're from all over, and they've got their home nation gods. So you've got the god of the Zidonians, which is a region in Syria, the Ashtaroth. You've got the Ammonites, Ammon and Moab, which you remember for Lot's descendants. So you got Milcom and then Chemosh for Moab, and Moloch also of Ammon. Moloch's the one who expects you to sacrifice your children as human sacrifices. So he starts building idols and worshiping these gods and really and pleasing his wives. So God's response is he is going to tear the nation from Solomon. Now, he's not going to do it in Solomon's day, really for David's sake. And so he's going to take it away from Solomon's son, Rehoboam. So God starts to raise up some adversaries to torment Solomon. One is Hadad, who's an Edomite who causes trouble. Another is Rezin, the Syrian. And then also there's a guy named Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam had actually been promoted to be the ruler over all the house of Joseph by Solomon. He saw he was an industrious young man, and he's going to put him in charge. Well, a prophet named Ahijah comes and finds Jeroboam and tells him that God is going to give 10 of the 12 tribes to you to rule over, to be king. Solomon hears about this, needless to say, he's not happy that this guy he's promoted is going to be king over 10 of the 12 tribes, so he tries to kill him. So Jeroboam has to flee to Egypt, which is a little interesting because one of the people that Solomon married was Pharaoh's daughter. So he's going to flee to either his father-in-law or, if time has passed enough, to his brother-in-law. So either way. So Solomon eventually dies. Chapter 11, he's reigned for 40 years. His son, Rehoboam, goes to Shechem. They're going to have this massive gathering. All the tribes are going to come, and they're going to confirm the kingdom to Rehoboam. The people make a request. They say, Solomon was really hard on us. He you know, burdened us, most likely he's talking about tax burdens. He put a lot of burdens on us. We want you to make them lighter. And so Rehoboam goes to two different groups of people, the old people, the old counselors of his father. He says, what do you think I ought to do? He says, you speak nicely to them and agree with them. They'll love you forever. It'll be great. He goes to the young men who have grown up with him and says, what do you think I ought to do? And they say, you know what? You got to show them you're tough. And so you got to speak roughly to them and say, you know, I'm tougher than any part of my father. And there's some really colorful language in there. And we'll get into that. You can go read it. But he ignores the counsel of the old men. And this is in fulfilling God's promise to rend the kingdom away from him. So by ignoring the counsel of the old men, he speaks roughly to the people saying, you know, my father chastised you with whips. I'm going to chastise you with scorpions. I'm going to be even fiercer and tougher than my father was. Well, 10 of the tribes, all except for Judah and Benjamin, say, you know what? Nah, we don't want you to be our king. And they eventually declare that Jeroboam, who's now come back from Egypt after hearing that Solomon's dead, they say, he's going to be our king. And so you have the formation of a new nation that is called Israel. Jeroboam is the first king of Israel. And I've got my little code there for I-1, Israel 1. Rehoboam is J-1, Judah 1. It gets complicated later in time. They got really similar names. There's often duplicates. And so I'm trying to just have some little code where I can put in these handouts of who are we talking about? What order? So maybe it'll be a little easier and you can see where that lines up and these do show up on the chart. Alright, so now you've got the split. Judah and Benjamin are the tribe of the nation of Judah, and then all the other 10 are going to be the tribe that are going to be the nation of Israel. Now, Rehoboam doesn't really get it. He winds up sending his tax collector to the other tribes and say, hey, you've got to pay tribute, and they stone him. He said, nope, we rejected you. I think it's after that they made Rehoboam the king. But so he flees for his life. He goes back to Jerusalem, gathers Judah and Benjamin together. They're going to get a big army. They're going to kick some butt. They're going to win and get the kingdom back. But God sends a prophet named Shemaiah, and he says, no. He's speaking not only to the king, the people. He says, you will not go fight your brothers. Go home. And whether Rehoboam wanted them to or not, the people all go home. And so the civil war didn't come to be. So Rehoboam remains king of just those two tribes, the nation of Judah and Benjamin. Now, Rehoboam, king of Israel, is a shrewd political operator, right? He knows that under the law, everyone in Israel is bound to go to Jerusalem 3 times a year to hold the 3 feasts. And he's afraid that if they do, they're going to go back and eventually decide that Rehoboam should be their king, and they're going to follow after him, and Rehoboam and Jeroboam is going to lose out, you know, being king. So what he does, he says, yeah, we've got some history with some gold calves. Aaron's already made one and said that they've come out of Egypt as the God that brought you out of Egypt. I'm going to make two. I'm going to put one in the south down here in Bethel, which is terrible. That's where Bethel means house of God. That's where Jacob had his dream and saw the vision of the ladder with angels going up and pointing to Jesus. Anyway, he puts the idol right there, and then another also in the city of Dan, which is in the far north part of of Israel. So it's also described as the northern kingdom. So he says, I'm going to make 2 golden calves, and these are going to be your gods. And they're the ones who brought you out of Egypt. And not only that, I'm going to create an annual feast. We're going to have it in the 8th month, and it's going to be very similar to the one that God instituted. So go, don't worry about going down to Jerusalem. You can just stay in Israel, and we'll worship here. And so throughout the rest of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, you're going to see these repeated references to the sin that Jeroboam led Israel to sin. This is what it's talking about. It's talking about these golden calves that led Israel into idolatry, worshiping things made of gold, and ascribing all the miracles that God had done for them coming out of Egypt to these stupid golden calves. Yeah. So chapter 13, a prophet from Judah, so the southern kingdom, goes to Bethel, where he's got one of the golden calves, and cries against Jeroboam and his altar. He set up an altar there and declares a prophecy. It says, one day, a king named Josiah is going to defile this altar that you've set up by sacrificing the priest, these idolatrous priests, upon it. And as a sign that that's going to come to pass one day, this altar will be broken in two. Well, altar snaps in two, the ashes break out. That prophecy isn't fulfilled till way down the road in 2 Kings 23 and 15, when the king Josiah does just that. Now, this prophet from Judah had been given instructions from God not to eat or drink anything while he's in Israel, and he's to come home a different way. Well, he starts hightailing it off. And for whatever reason, there's another prophet there in Israel who goes to him and lies and says, you know, I got a vision from God. He says you can come home and eat and drink with me, and it's okay. And so the prophet from Judah does so. And then the deceitful prophet gets a real vision from God that says, you disobeyed me, you're going to die. And so when the prophet from Judah goes home, God sends a lion to slay him, kills him, and he's lying in the road. He doesn't eat him, he just killed him. Didn't even hurt the animal he was riding up into the donkey. And so that prophet winds up being buried in the sepulcher of the deceitful prophet and the prophet Judah wind up being buried together in time. And so neither here nor there, other than that, will come up later in time, just that story. So, chapter 14, Jeroboam, so this is the first king of Israel, his wife is sent disguised to go visit the old blind prophet Ahijah. Who's Ahijah? This is that same prophet that told Jeroboam that he was going to be king and get 10 of the tribes. Now, after hearing that, he still decided it was more important to create these golden calves and get into idolatry for political power than following the Lord. So he sends his wife, says, go ask that prophet to see if our son Ahijah, she's going to check on Ahijah from Ahijah the prophet. And, you know, the prophet's blind, but God tells her, you know, the wife is coming, and so she gets a message for Jeroboam. Because of his sin, Jeroboam's house is going to be utterly destroyed. We use the term utterly cut off. Anyone who pisses against the walls, all the males, are going to be destroyed. And so the only good thing about your house is this young sick son. And so because of the goodness that I found in him, I'm going to allow him to die and to be buried in peace. Because everyone else is going to die like you would in war. And just lie in the field kind of thing. So she goes home, and as soon as she crosses the threshold of the doorway, the child dies. So Jeroboam winds up reigning for a total of 22 years, and then upon his death, his son, Nadab, becomes the second king of Israel. Going back to Judah, Rehoboam, following in the path that Solomon set up in his latter years, is engaging in idolatry too. And in fact, even more so than Solomon. And it's describing that there are, you know, sodomites in the land, which is clearly prohibited under Deuteronomy 23 and 17. And this is the same activity that was going on in the land and kingdom before Israel came in. And so he's allowing that to continue. He winds up reigning for 17 years. And then upon his death, his son, by Jam, reigns as the second king. All right. So we're up to chapter 15, about 1240. We might not finish all this today. That's okay. So let's look in Judah first. We get by Jam, day two, second king. He only reigns for 3 years. Like his father, he was a bad king. He engaged in idolatry. He was followed by his son, Asa, who is the third king. He reigns for a long time. He reigns for 41 years. He was a good king. He reformed Israel. He put away the idols and tried to follow everything that was supposed to be under the law. The only thing he didn't do was he didn't take away those high places where people were going to sacrifice instead of the temple. Now, over on the other side of the coin in Israel, Nadab, which is Jeroboam's son, he's murdered. He's murdered after only reigning for 2 years. And the guy who murdered him, his name is Baasha. He's a guy of Issachar. Baasha becomes the third king of Israel. But before he does that, he destroys all of Jeroboam's family, which fulfills that prophecy that Ahijah gave to Jeroboam's wife. So he destroys them all. They're all cut off. And then he retains power for 24 years. And he continues in that idolatry that Jeroboam had started with golden calves. All right. Chapter 16, God sends a prophet named Jehu. There's another Jehu down the road who becomes a king of Israel, not that Jehu. This Jehu is a prophet. He goes to cry against I3, Baasha, for all his evil ways, and to tell him that his house is going to be utterly destroyed. And this word is going to be fulfilled by the captain of half of Bashar's chariots, Zimri. Now, why is that significant? The captain of half of Bashar's chariots tells me he's not the top general. That's one thing to be murdered by your top general. This guy's like lower in the pecking order. He's not even over all the chariots, just half of them. So Zimri, this little upstart officer, decides he's going to be king. He kills Bashar. He reigns for a total of 7 days. The rest of Israel, who happens to be off at war at the time, appoints that top general, Omri, to be the king while they're away, and they go and attack the city of Tirzah, where Zimri is at, and that's where the palace was at the time. Zimri, seeing that he's lost, and the whole rest of the army is coming to kill him, he decides he's going to kill himself by setting the king's palace on fire with him inside it. So that's how Zimri expires after 7 days. So Omri, that top general of Israel, becomes the fifth king of Israel. He goes and builds the city of Samaria. Samaria becomes the capital of Israel. And often in scripture, you'll see the term Samaria being used synonymously with the nation of Israel. So it can be shorthand. If you say Samaria, you could be talking about the city, but you could also be using it to describe the entire country. So he reigns for a total of 6 years. And then when he dies, you get his son, Ahab, becoming king number six of Israel, and he stays in power a long time. He gets 22 years. Ahab marries this lovely young lady named Jezebel. Totally facetious. She's terrible. She's a princess. She's a princess of the Zidonian king, which is a region in Syria, and brings with her worship of Baal. So there's tears of idolatry, apparently. You know, you've got worshiping golden cows that are getting credit for what God did, and then there's worshiping Baal, which is apparently way worse. And I'm not sure exactly if it's in this chapter, but just as a nugget, one of Jezebel's hostility towards God is that she winds up making sure that all of his prophets are slaughtered and killed. And so just bad folks. And another aside, during this chapter, I do know that, during Ahab's days, you have an Israelite from Bethel, where one of the golden calves was. He went to Jericho, which had been completely destroyed by Joshua and then cursed. And in the curse, in Joshua 16:26, it says, you know, whoever rebuilds the city is going to pay for it in both his youngest and his oldest son. He starts and finishes it, sets up the foundation, and sets up the gates. If you're starting and ending of building the city. And so this man does. He rebuilds the city and loses his two children as a consequence. So Jericho is now back on the scene. Later, we'll see that the water around there was still cursed, and so it was a barren land, and so one of the prophets down lined up clearing up that water. So just kind of hang with me on that concept. Chapter 17, God sends Elijah. He's Elijah. Yeah, this is one of the more famous prophets, Elijah. He's Elijah the Tishbite from Gilead. And Gilead is that region on our side of Jordan, East Manasseh. He sends him from Gilead to go to prophesy against Ahab, Israel 16. And here's the prophecy. It says, God's not going to permit there to rain or even have dew on the ground for years. Turns out to be 3.5 years, which, again, an agrarian society, it's not like you can just import food from afar. It causes a terrible, terrible famine. And you can see James 5, 7 through 18 talking about the length of the years. Those 3.5 years if there was no rain. So God sends Elijah to the brook of Cherith, little stream, and from there God sends your first air delivery service of food by ravens. He brings it to Elijah, and he eats the meat that they bring and drinks from the brook until the brook completely dries up. Then God sends him to a Gentile city of Zarephath unto a widow woman, who is out in her yard gathering some sticks because she's about to go make the last little cake for herself and her son, and then they're going to die. They got no more food. The famine's so bad. They've got just a little barrel with a little bit of, you know, meal and a little cruse of oil. And Elijah says, you know, that's okay. Just make me a cake first. Well, either way, he winds up, all three of them wind up eating on that little barrel of meal, a little cruse of oil, miraculously, for many, many, many days during the famine. So that's how God sustained Elijah, and the woman and the son got the benefit. Later, the woman's son dies, and Elijah actually prays that God would send the soul back into the child, and God does so. And we'll talk about this at the end, and then I get to today, but this is the first example of a resurrection of someone who's dead coming back to life in Scripture. So, chapter 18, Elijah is sent by God back to King Ahab, the sixth king of Israel, and he faces off against 450 of these prophets who worship Baal, that idol of the Syrians, the Sidonians. And so they have a contest. They set up two altars. They have two cows or oxen or some kind of animal that they cut up, and they set them there, and they say, here's the deal. Whoever's God is real will send down fire to burn up this offering. So he says, you know, there's 450 of y'all go first. And so they spend all day hooping and hollering and cutting themselves and asking Baal to bring fire down. And Elijah's just mocking them. He's like, well, maybe he's asleep. You need to wake him up. Or maybe he's on a trip and we can't hear you right now. And so anyway, about the time that it's for the evening sacrifice, Elijah says, all right, my turn. And so he builds the altar back up, puts his animal on there, has them pour like 12 barrels full of water over this thing, and then he asked God to send down fire, and God immediately does, and the fire was so hot, not only did it consume the burnt offering, it consumed the altar, which was made out of stone, and all the water that had been poured on and around in this little trench around it. And so God, Elijah, you know, tells the people they need to choose, are they going to serve God or Baal? And so after seeing that, the people turn to God, and at Elijah's command, they go and they slay the 450 prophets of Baal, which really ticks off Jezebel. Now, God ultimately sends some rain to end the drought. So we'll jump down to key verse 2 there as well. Elijah came unto all the people and said, how long halt ye between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal be God, follow him. And people answered him not a word. They couldn't make up their mind who they were going to serve. So you've got this massive demonstration of God's power. God sends rain. Chapter 19, Jezebel sends a little note. She said, I'm going to kill you by tomorrow. And so Elijah hightails it out of there. He goes fleeing. At some point during his journey, he's met by an angel who gives him some food, which sustains him as he walks 40 days eating nothing else, to Mount Horeb, which is also Mount Sinai, and this is where Moses received the law. God comes to meet him there at Mount Horeb. And this is when you've got that scene where God comes in a still, small voice rather than in, I think it was earthquake and fire. And so this is Hebrews 3. This is, go forth and stand upon the mountain before the Lord. This is 19:11-12. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great strong wind rent the mountains, breaking the mountains by the wind, breaking pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord is not in the wind, and after the wind, an earthquake. The Lord is not in the earthquake, and after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord is not in the fire, and after the fire, a still, small voice. The key verse 3. And so that's God speaking to Elijah there on the mountain, and he gives him some commands. He says, Jehu is going to need to be anointed to be the king over Israel. Not the prophet, another guy down in time. Hazael is going to be anointed to be the king over Syria. And Elisha is going to be the new prophet. You're going to die soon. You're going to go away soon. You need to appoint Elijah to be your replacement. So Elijah here on the mountain is really having a pity party about how he's the only one left to serve the Lord, and it'd probably be better if the Lord just killed him. And God reveals to him that no, he's not the only one left. He has still got a remnant among Israel. There are 7,000 people who have not bowed down and served that false god of idol. Of Baal. So Elijah leaves the mountain and he goes and he finds Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who's going to be his servant for a while and then ultimately his replacement. And as he's walking by, he takes his mantle off of him, his cloak or wrap, tosses it on Elisha, and Elisha, after quickly bidding goodbye to his family, follows Elijah. We got about 8 more minutes. We can do it. Alright. Chapter 20. Then Hadad, who is the king of Syria at this time, comes to Samaria, capital of Israel, and encircles it in a siege. God winds up delivering the Syrian army into Ahab's hand 3 times, and he does it for a reason. So Ahab will learn and know that God is the Lord. However, Ahab disobeys God by not killing Ben-Hadad, and another prophet has to come to Ahab and tell him that his life is going to be in exchange for the man who is appointed for destruction and given into Ahab's hand that he let go. So Ahab had the chance to destroy Ben-Hadad, but instead he made peace treaty with him, basically. Chapter 21, Jezebel, Ahab's queen, has a man named Naboth murdered. Now, Naboth, he basically had a vineyard that was next door to Ahab's. It was nice. Ahab wanted to convert it to a herb garden. He goes to him and he asks politely, hey, let me buy that from you or give you some other land. You know, I want your garden. And Naboth says, no, it's part of my inheritance. I'm not going to give it up. And so Ahab goes back to his house and pouts. He won't eat or drink. He's laying on his bed pouting. His wife comes in, asks what the problem is. And she says, don't worry about it, honey. I'll take care of it. So she sends word to the elders there to arrange for Naboth to be accused of blaspheming God and then murdered and then killed for it, which is really ironic for an idolatrous nation to care so much about blaspheming God's name that they'd still institute the death penalty. Either way, either there. So because she does that, Elijah is sent to proclaim that Ahab's house is going to be utterly cut off. And not only that, that the dogs are going to lick up Ahab's blood, which is gross, and the dogs are going to eat Jezebel's body. Now, surprisingly, in hearing this news, Ahab humbles himself before the Lord in sackcloth and ashes, and God elects to defer the punishment. He doesn't change his mind. The punishment is still going to happen, but he waits until after Ahab's dead to fulfill it. So, chapter 22, we're introduced to Asa's son. Asa's king 3 of Judah, his son Jehoshaphat, 4th king. He winds up joining forces with that wicked king Ahab, and they're going to fight their common enemy, Syria. They go and inquire of all the prophets, and all the prophets say, yep, go up, God's on your side, you're going to win, all except for one, this prophet named Micaiah. He reveals that God has sent a lion spirit to these prophets to declare that they should go up because Ahab is going to die in this battle. And so he tells them, Ahab, you're going to die. Ahab decides he's going to somehow outsmart God, so he goes to the battle anyway, but he disguises himself. He doesn't wear his kingly robes. Jehoshaphat wears his kingly robes. And the Syrian king had been given instructions to this group of men saying, go find the king of Israel. Don't chase anybody else. Just get him. And so they start chasing after Jehoshaphat, the guy who looks like a king. But he's crying out, and they eventually discover it's not him, and so they go off looking somewhere else. Well, Ahab, who is in disguise, he winds up being killed by just an arrow shot at random. I mean, the Lord obviously providentially directed it, but he's still killed. And it does describe the guy who washed out his chariots, the dogs were licking up the blood. So his son, Hazael reigns for 2 years, as the seventh king of Israel, and he did evil just like his father. And we learn more about him in 2 Kings, so it's just kind of a notation that he exists here, the last paragraph or two. And we learn that Jehoshaphat, reigned for 25 years over the nation of Judah, and he followed the good ways of the Lord just like his father Asa. We looked at our 3 key verses. How does this book point to Jesus? Okay, well, it's a history, and so you may say, well, how does this point to Jesus at all? I mean, one, we're still following the bloodline of Jesus through the kings. David is going to come down through his line, so the tribe of Judah, those kings, are going to all be in the bloodline of Jesus Christ. But probably more interesting is the first resurrection, the revival of that Zidonian woman's son by Elijah. That's the first recorded miracle of bringing a dead person back to life. That's the definition of a resurrection, to make alive again. Jesus actually references this miracle when he's teaching that a prophet has honor everywhere except for in his own town and among his own people. And during his teaching, he actually points to the inclusion of Gentiles being inside Jesus's fold of sheep, or within the children of God, which was a really new concept, because before this, all the promises had been made to natural Israel. So Luke 4:25-6 says, "But I tell you the truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elias, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, there's your time frame again, which agrees with James, when the great famine was throughout the land. But unto none of them was Elias," which is the Greek spelling of Elijah, "sent, save to Sarepta, a city of Zidon, unto a woman that was a widow." So he's saying, you know, of all the people in Israel, all the widows that he could have sent Elijah to, he went to a Gentile woman. And then if you couple that with John 10:16, it says, "Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, I must bring," is talking about Jesus gathering the Gentiles to himself as well. So Jesus's resurrection, which is, you know, alluded to, pointed up to him. I think there's only 3 resurrections in the New Testament, and then there's 3 resurrections that Jesus performs before himself. So Jesus' resurrection declares God's acceptance of Jesus' sacrifice on the behalf of each of his children as the complete payment for their sins. If he had made a single mistake and hadn't taken away all their sins, then the resurrection wouldn't have happened, because the work wouldn't have been complete. No one said, "It is finished." It's actually finished. There was nothing left to do, and the resurrection was evidence of that. All right. And then just real briefly, I know we've only got just a minute or two, just pull up a copy of the chart, and y'all can, this would be something to really kind of chew on and study on. What I would like is if y'all look at it and give me feedback. I mean, I know what I'm thinking as I'm crafting this, but for someone who hasn't spent 10 or 15 hours playing with it, look at it and tell me if there's ways we could make it more useful or edifying, easier to gather it. So the structure, just left to right, is we've got accumulative years of keeping track, starting from when Saul was anointed king, how long we got going down, and then we've got the length of the individual reigns. What book do these events occur in? And this is not a complete list. I haven't gone through Chronicles all the way yet for all of them. And then also, who are the major prophets in place? You got Samuel, Gad, and Nathan, and then Ahijah, Edo, Jehu, and Elijah, and then, you know, Elisha really picks up in 2 Kings. So y'all would just look at that and give me any feedback. That would be really helpful. We got 1 minute, so I'm